From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, pure pop for now people. Singer, songwriter, musician, and record producer Nick Lowe brings his guitar and plays his musical biography. In the 1970s, with the band Brinsley Schwartz, Lowe helped start the pub rock movement in England. He then produced the first recordings by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. He has a new solo album, and of course, he'll also perform some songs from it. Our commentator, Dagoberto Gilb, is a writer who used to make a living as a carpenter, so his recent book tour was a real adventure. He'll tell us about it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Prosecutors in the O.J. Simpson murder case are using their opening statements to paint the former football star as a person who needed to control his relationship with his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson. Simpson himself won't be allowed to speak to the jury during the defense's opening statements, but he will be able to show them what he says are his physical limitations. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW reports from Los Angeles.
Deputy District Attorney Christopher Darden told the jury O.J. Simpson had two faces. One he presented to the public in commercials and movies. The other, the face Nicole saw during the 17 years of their relationship. Darden said Simpson controlled what Nicole wore, who she saw, he controlled the money, and finally he used a more forceful form of control, violence. Darden says Simpson could not accept the fact when Nicole finally called it quits. In his mind, she belonged to him, Darden concluded, and if he couldn't have her, nobody could. After Darden spoke, it was up to Prosecutor Marcia Clark to show the jury that Simpson had a clear hour and a half to actually commit the murder. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
A business group is blasting President Clinton's decision to seek a raise in the minimum wage. Mr. Clinton is expected to raise the issue tonight in his State of the Union address. The National Federation of Independent Business says the minimum wage is a sort of tax on small business. The Federation's president, Jack Ferris, says the hike could fuel inflation as businesses pass costs on to consumers. He also says it could mean job cuts as businesses lay off workers to cut costs. A study in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association provides strong new evidence that a controversial blood test for prostate cancer is highly accurate. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
The PSA blood test is commonly used by physicians to screen patients for prostate cancer. Some argue the test has become too common, that it produces many false positives, leading men to seek treatment when there's nothing wrong. Researchers at Harvard Medical School studied the blood of almost 1,500 middle-aged to elderly men that was collected more than a decade ago, before the PSA test was available. The scientists found that the test could accurately identify most of the men who went on to develop prostate cancer in the following 5 years. The test provided false positives only about 10% of the time. While this suggests the PSA test is very accurate, doctors still aren't sure what to do with the results. Studies suggest treating prostate cancer can often cause more problems than it solves. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up a point at 3,868. Trading is heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq has risen 3.25 points to 762. This is NPR. Chechnya's president is reportedly seeking help from Libya's president Muammar Gaddafi. Russian television says Dzhokhar Dudayev called Gaddafi and appealed for help in ending the war with Russia. Lightly armed Chechen separatists are trying to fight Russian soldiers who are much better equipped. The rebels have been carrying out hit-and-run attacks on Russian forces, which continue to hit strongly with artillery. Dudayev told a Moscow radio station today his forces have surrounded the Russians. The Russians say they have effectively broken the Chechens into small groups. Both Republican and Democratic members of the Senate Finance Committee are backing legislation that would restore the deductibility of health insurance for self-employed workers. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Since 1986, some 9 million self-employed workers have been able to take a 25% tax deduction for their health insurance. But that provision expired at the end of last year when Congress failed to renew it. Democrat David Pryor says Congress should act quickly and restore the deduction for tax year 1994. People could then get the money back by filing an amended return. Republican Charles Grassley says Congress should gradually increase the deduction each year so that by 1997, self-employed workers could deduct 100% of the cost for buying insurance.
Most agree that an increased health insurance deduction would lead to significant reduction in the number of uninsured in America.
Grassley says restoring the 25% deduction for 1994 would cost about $300 million, and they're still figuring out how to pay for that. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Former pro tennis player Chris Evert has been elected to the International Tennis Hall of Fame. She'll be inducted this July in ceremonies in Rhode Island. She's one of only a few players to be unanimously elected since 1980. She came to national attention in 1971 when she reached the U.S. Open semifinals as a high school student. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have some great music for you today. My guest is British singer, songwriter, bass player, guitarist, and record producer Nick Lowe. We asked him to bring his guitar and play a sort of musical biography for us. Of course, we'll also do some songs from his new CD, The Impossible Bird. At the start of his career, back in the 1970s, Nick Lowe helped move rock forward by getting it back in touch with its roots. As a member of the band Brinsley Schwartz, he was one of London's first pub rockers. As house producer for the new wave label Stiff, he produced the first albums by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. In 1979, Lowe's own record, Cruel to Be Kind, made the American Top 20. Another of his well-known songs, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding, was recorded by Elvis Costello. A version by Curtis Stigers is featured on the soundtrack of the film The Bodyguard. The first song Nick Lowe's going to play for us is from his new album. It's called The Beast in Me, and Lowe wrote it for Johnny Cash, who was Lowe's father-in-law back when Lowe was married to Carlene Carter. I asked Nick Lowe why he wrote the song for Johnny Cash.
It was a little task I set myself, I suppose. I suppose I thought about it originally in 1980, and I thought up this terrific title, The Beast in Me, which I thought would be so... That's a start, I thought, for Johnny Cash. And I wanted to get a few sort of crypto-religious terms in there and things like that. You know, it was a kind of a cynical exercise, except I thought the title was really good.
Well, what was cynical about this?
Well, because it was a sort of paint by numbers kind of thing. I suppose I was thinking of, you know, I thought, yes, this is a big man torn down, you know, but because of this terrible thing within him, you know, I thought, this is right up John's street. And I thought up the song, and the first verse came very, very quickly. And it was one of those songs, really, where I said it all in the first verse. I couldn't really think of what else to say. Nonetheless, being the consummate professional that I am, I went ahead and I finished the song rather quickly, really. And John, being the lovely man and wonderful musician that he is, spotted this. And he could see that I'd rushed this thing. And he said to me, gently, look, you're onto a good thing here, but you haven't quite got it right. I think you should have another shot at this. Which I did periodically. I'd sort of mentally get the song out and dust it off. Generally, after I'd seen him in the intervening years, as I say, this is 1980 when I first thought it up. And he'd always, you know, whenever I'd see him, he'd say, how's the Beast in Me song going, Nick? And so I dusted off a bit, and I wouldn't really get any further. And he'd always ask me how it was going. And then the year before last, I had a sort of a revelation. I realised the song wasn't actually really about Johnny Cash at all. It was kind of about me and most people I know. And once I realised that, suddenly, you know, a kind of a light went on, and I managed to finish the song quite easily, and it all seemed to fall into shape, and I can't understand what all the trouble I had was.
So once you realized that it was about the beast in you also, there was more to be said?
It's more the beast in one.
And the beast in one. I like that. Why don't you do the song for us?
Yeah, sure. The beast in me
is caged by frail and fragile barns. Restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me has had to learn to live with pain and how to shelter from the rain. And in the twinkling of an eye, might have to be restrained. God help the beast in me. Sometimes it tries to kid me that it's just a teddy bear, or even somehow managed to vanish in the air. Then that is when I must beware of the beast in me, that everybody knows. They've seen him out dressed in my clothes, patently unclear if it's New York or New
I have to tell you, the first time I heard the song was on Johnny Cash's latest album. And I really liked the song a lot. And I said, well, I bet when Nick Lowe does it, he does it with a lot of irony. And I guess I was wrong.
Yes, I think it's a serious song. Although, when I hear John's version of it, I think that he's such a great interpreter. And he is really, I mean, he says, God damn the beast in me. Whereas, I say, God help the beast in me. Because the beast in me, I think, I feel quite a lot of affection towards. Because I think it's a sort of a bumbling goon more than something that's truly beastly and evil. It's something that I feel sort of affectionate towards. So it's just a question of interpretation. But I think it's a serious tune, yeah.
On the whole, do you think that there's less irony in general on your new album than in previous works?
Well, I don't think it's po-faced, you know, and sort of, okay, I've grown up now, you know, the joke's over. You know, the kind of music I like has to be saucy. It's got to be saucy, otherwise it's tiresome and you know, it's boys' music. Comes out as boys' music, and I've been a little boy, you know. I know what that's like, and it was a lot of fun as well. But time to move on.
I'd like you to do another song from the new album. It's called "Where's My Everything." Is this a new song?
Yes, quite. Yes, it's certainly newer than The Beast in Me. Yeah, yes. I suppose I thought this one up. Last year.
And this one does have, I think, a taste of irony.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This has got a little irony, because it's got a sort of jaunty tune. You know, it's got glum words with a jaunty tune.
Does it tell us something about writing it?
Well, I had a friend who used to say this, you know. It was a joke, but they'd say, where's my thing? And in fact, come to think of it, where's my everything? And it seemed funny at the time. And I couldn't. In fact, Engelbert Humperdinck. Come to think of it, Engelbert Humperdinck said, "There goes my reason for living." I suppose it's a variation on that theme, isn't it?
Right. So this is Nick Lowe, and he's going to perform for us a song that's also on his new record, The Impossible Bird.
Where is the beautiful family home that I was promised on the news at 10? Like my personal place in the sun, it never happened alone. And as for the greatest love of all, that's been sworn in a billion lines and is mine by birthright, of it I've seen none. Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Where are the children 2.3 that were meant to be sent to me? The patter of whose tiny feet made my life so sweet. They've been filed along with a pot of gold that was meant to cement my nest and help to keep out the cold while keeping in the rest. Tell me now where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Where is the monument I'll leave to a grateful nation whose citizens will bend the knee each time my tale is told? Tell me where's my everything? They've been filed along with a pot of gold that was meant to cement my nest and help to keep out the cold while keeping in the rest. Tell me now where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything? Tell me where's my everything?
That's a great song. I love the idea of a nation bending its knee when it
yeah.
when you tell your story. Singer, songwriter, guitarist, bass player, Nick Lowe is my guest. He has a new album called The Impossible Bird, and he's here with his guitar, and we're going to talk some more. He'll play some more. But first, why don't we take a short break?
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Nick Lowe, and he's got a new album called The Impossible Bird. I'd like to do a little musical biography with you. What came first for you, singing, songwriting, guitar, bass? The chicken, the egg?
No, my mum actually taught me a few chords initially. I used to have one little plastic banjo thing that were all the rage in the 50s, and I was about 8. She could play the guitar a little bit, and she bought me this little plastic banjo. And my hero at the time was a fellow called Lonnie Donegan, who was the nearest you could really get to a rock and roll singer in England. In fact, he was an Irishman, in fact, but he had a voice that used to get up the grown-ups' noses, you know, because he used to kind of sing like that. And he used to do a strange mixture of kind of country and western and almost trad jazz stuff. He did a lot of songs by Lead Belly, you know, and Mississippi Fred McDowell and those sort of country blues players, and put this kind of stomping beat to it. And they called it skiffle music, and it started it was a big craze in the 50s.
Well, the Americans, we Americans knew the hit the awful song. Does your chewing gum lose its flavor?
Rather a shame. Yes. Yeah. Does your chewing gum lose its flavor? And he had a succession of those kind of gimmick songs, and they were the worst things he did, really,
well,
sadly.
Give us a sense of something good that he did.
Oh, let me think now. I don't know, it might seem very quaint, but like, to me, at 8 years old, it sounded wild. He did a song called Railroad Bill, I remember, which was written.
Well, Railroad Bill, Railroad Bill, he never works and he never will. I'm gonna ride a Railroad Bill, I'm gonna ride a Railroad Bill. Well, now Railroad Bill is by the railroad track, waiting for the freight train to come back. Train come back, make no stop. Railroad Bill, he gonna ride the top. Railroad Bill, Railroad Bill, he never works and he never will. I'm gonna ride Railroad Bill, I'm gonna ride Railroad Bill.
That sort of thing. Simple and cheerful.
Okay, so you're around, what, 7 or 8 or 9 or something?
Yes,
around this period.
Railroad.
and you're playing duets with your mom. Mm. So when did you start listening to rock and roll, and what did you hear that excited you early on?
Oh, well, you know, I remember my mother leaping like a startled stag across the room when Tutti Frutti came on, Little Richard singing Tutti Frutti came on, and Great Balls of Fire. I remember those coming. We were, my father was in the Royal Air Force, and so when I was a kid, I was stationed wherever he was sent, you know. And so I'm thinking of when we were living in Cyprus at that time, when these records came out, and they were all in the forces network, which was behind even the BBC at that time. I'm talking about 1957, 56, 57.
So you were the last to know when a record.
I was
came
the
out.
Very last to know. Yeah.
So you were already gravitating toward guitar, I guess.
Well, I suppose so. I did. I pressed on with my banjo thing. I liked the Kingston Trio. I went through a thing of sweaters and nice side parting hair, you know.
Did he ever return?
What, the bloke on the MTA?
Yeah, yeah.
Who cares?
So, play for me a snatch of like early rock and roll that made you think, I can do, this is me, I like this kind of music, I can play it, I can sing it.
Well, I think probably the first rock and roll that I really thought I could play was the pre-Beatles English rock and roll, like Cliff Richard, you know. And he did a sort of Elvis act, you know, when he was young. When you go, I kiss you good night. Yeah, he's got this goony voice. I kiss you good night, and what do I do? I hurry on home and dream about you. It's crazy, I know, but it's not one of those things. I don't want to be da-da-da-da-da. Do your apron ring?
So,
yeah,
was he important, more important to you than Elvis was?
Yeah, he was really. Yeah, so Elvis was really sort of a bit before my time. My sister, I had an older sister. I have an older sister, and she was an Elvis fan. But and I thought he was pretty good. But it was really after I got older that I realised how great Elvis was at the time. Because my sister liked Elvis Presley, and she liked Pat Boone. And I thought Elvis Presley was just like Pat Boone, you know.
Perceptive kid.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering if Elvis Presley would have seemed out of reach to you also, you know, far away, another culture.
Yes, I suppose so. I couldn't really quite get it. But Cliff Richard, when he first started, I understood that.
Now, what about when the Beatles hit it? Did they make an impact on you?
Oh, yeah, of course. I was perfect age group, you know, to be totally, you know, the Beatles were totally aimed at. And that was when it all, I thought, oh, well, this is the ticket.
What did you hear in them that you hadn't heard before?
What a question. I mean, they were just, it was like nothing else had ever happened before them. And everything that, the attendant thing, the business that came, it was the reason why it was so great to be a teenager, excuse me, in the 60s, all that, you know, it meant, it was more than the music, really. But I can't recall. They just had such a great sound, and they were, No, I can't think of one. I haven't quite figured that out.
Were you writing songs yet?
No. That wasn't until... I did... The first song I wrote, actually, was I wrote a song which I can't remember, but it was about the... I think it was in the style of the Kingston Trio, and it was about the great train robbery. You know, there was a great mail train robbery in England. I thought, oh, this is really... I can make this like the Deadwood stage or something. But no, it wasn't really until till I joined a... I left home. I went professional, became a professional musician, but basically I went from earning some money in the sort of dead-end job that I had to earning none whatsoever as a professional musician. But then in those days, that's the end of the 60s, about 1968, if you didn't write your own songs, if your group didn't write your own songs, then there was no point. You were just cabaret.
Well, what was the turning point for you in realizing you could write songs that related to your experience and weren't about some great train robbery?
Oh, well, I don't know. There's nothing wrong about writing about the great train robbery either. But I don't really know. I don't really have a handle on how the whole songwriting thing goes. I have to be inspired to do it, really. I'm not very disciplined. I know some people can really discipline themselves. John Hyatt, for instance, a friend of mine, John, he goes to work each day, you know. He kisses the wife and kids goodbye, and he's got an office in town with a piano and an amp in and everything. And off he goes, and he goes to write songs. Well, I can't possibly do that. I'm far too lazy.
Can you play a chorus of the first song that you wrote that you thought, this is a decent song?
Oh, wow. The first song that I wrote that I thought was a decent song. Yeah, I think I probably can if I remember it. It was called There's a Cloud in My Heart. It went, let me just remember this. You've sprung this on me, you see. There's a cloud in my heart, and it's pouring with rain, and it ain't gonna stop until you come back again. I've been drowning my sorrows, God knows what else I've tried, but no matter what, I still can't get you out of my mind. And there's no substitute, although I have to admit that some were really cute. Nobody else will do something, something better than you.
I like that. That's really catchy.
Yeah, I remember I tried to get Del Shannon to record.
Oh,
that.
Boy, yeah.
Because I thought little falsetto thing. I thought that Del would like that.
Nick Lowe, he'll be back with us in the second part of our show. He has a new CD called The Impossible Bird, and he's on a concert tour that's taking him across America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Random House, publisher of Philip K. Howard's The Death of Common Sense, How the Law is Suffocating America. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more of our concert and interview with Nick Lowe. We'll end the concert by asking him to play something out of character, a song written by someone else that we might not expect he'd like. And commentator Dagoberto Gilb reports on his recent book tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Prosecutors in the O.J. Simpson murder trial are in the middle of their opening statements. They're asking the jury to look past Simpson's public image to his private face. They say Simpson's private persona is that of a wife-beater. The former football star is accused of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. Prosecutor Christopher Darden says the jurors will have to decide, did O.J. Simpson really kill Brown and Goldman?
We'll answer that question from the witness stand and from the exhibits you'll see in this case and from the evidence. And when you see the evidence and when you hear the witnesses and when you put it all together and consider the totality of circumstances in this case, the answer will be clear to you as well. The answer to the question is yes.
Simpson's defense team will present its opening remarks after the lunch break is over when the prosecution has completed its statement. The Federal Marshals Service is offering protection to 12 abortion doctors. The physicians have been targeted by an anti-abortion group, the American Coalition of Life Activists. They're based in Portland, Oregon. The group says it is encouraging peaceful methods to expose the 12. A spokesman for the Marshals Service says some of the doctors on the list have accepted the protection office, or rather offer. Democrats are accusing the Republicans of imposing a second gag rule like the one imposed last week on Representative Carrie Meek. UPI's Carol Van Dam prepared this report.
In an emotional one-minute speech, House Democratic leader Richard Gephardt attacked Republican leaders for instituting what he calls another gag rule.
This motion last night was wrong, it was undemocratic, and I call upon all of my colleagues to resist it and denounce it for what it is, a gag rule on the people of this House.
Gentlemen.
Late last night, House Majority Leader Richard Armey announced that in the interest of keeping with the Republicans' promise to act on their contract with America in 100 days, votes in committees could be held while the full House is in session. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Israeli radio and Palestinian reporters say Israeli authorities are raiding West Bank hideouts and homes, searching for members of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. A mosque has been ransacked. Authorities have beefed up security in the wake of this weekend's suicide bomb attack that killed 19 people. President Clinton is freezing U.S. assets of a dozen groups and 18 people suspected of terrorism. The White House says the executive order also seeks to restrict their ability to raise money in the United States. The White House says the action is part of the administration's sweeping effort to strike back at terrorists. President Clinton joined other world leaders in deploring the weekend bombing in Israel. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow fell more than 4 points to end at 3,862. Advancing issues led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. An attorney for Commerce Secretary Ron Brown is denying charges that Brown misled Congress about profits from an investment company in which he once owned a major stake. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The chairman of the House Government Oversight and Reform Committee says a year-long investigation has turned up evidence linking Brown to Corridor Broadcasting Corporation. The company defaulted on a Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation loan in 1993, costing taxpayers over $20 million. Representative William Klinger, a Pennsylvania Republican, has asked Brown to provide complete information about a promissory note to Corridor. The note was owed by Corridor to First International Communications Corporation. Before becoming Commerce Secretary, Brown was co-owner of First International. Klinger has told Brown the existence of the note seems contrary to Brown's earlier statements that he had no business ties with Corridor Broadcasting. Brown's attorney says the Commerce Secretary was not aware that First International held a Corridor note. He says Brown never used his office to benefit himself and that Brown never had a conflict of interest in any way. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Salt Lake City is one of four finalist cities that are bidding to host the 2002 Winter Olympics. The other cities are Östersund, Sweden, Quebec, Canada, and Sion, Switzerland. Five other cities have been eliminated. The 100 members of the International Olympic Committee will choose the winner on June 16th. The secret ballot will be held in Budapest. The relief group Doctors for Asia is appealing for help from Japanese doctors and nurses. The group says injured quake victims in central Japan may be without access to care. The Japanese health ministry has now relaxed restrictions on foreign doctors who would volunteer to help. The ministry had imposed severe limits on foreign doctors because they didn't have Japanese medical licenses. The death toll from the quake last week is now 5,063. 68 people are still missing. Japanese news reports say nearly half the dead are older than 60. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with the second half of our performance and interview with British singer, songwriter, guitarist, and record producer Nick Lowe. Lowe is a member of the groups Brinsley Schwartz, Rockpile, and Little Village, and has produced records by Elvis Costello and Graham Parker. His new solo CD is called The Impossible Bird. When you started writing songs, did you think of yourself as writing them for yourself? Did you know you wanted to sing?
Gotta sing, gotta dance. Initially, it was just... At that time, there wasn't, with the exception of probably being a fighter pilot, there wasn't anything cooler for a young white male to be in a pop group. Well, nothing was cooler. Now I think it's kind of lame. You know, I think if I was 17 or 18, I'm not sure whether I'd feel the same way. But it really didn't have anything to do with anything artistic to start with, I don't think, except that I found I could do it. But it was just the coolest thing that you could do was to be in a group. And, of course, then we went off to... Germany, you know, the thing that is well documented now that the Beatles did, you know, playing in those nightclubs.
We being Brinsley Schwartz?
It was a group called Kippington Lodge that I was in.
The predecessor.
And we'd go often to these clubs in Germany where you'd have a residency for a month and you'd play sort of all night and all day and all night at the weekends.
Would you do your own songs or cover songs?
No, we hardly wrote our own songs then. It was all covers, but you had to have an enormous repertoire, obviously, you know. And it was a wonderful experience for a 17, 18-year-old kid, you know. It was just seeing life in the raw. I was being very sheltered up till then.
You had mentioned before that your father was in the Royal Air Force, so you traveled according to where he was stationed. Mm. I'm wondering if he or other parents that you knew listened to music that you really didn't like, that you saw your music as being in opposition to.
Well, actually, my dad is quite cloth-eared, really. His idea of heaven is... I always used to think that he was cloth-eared. In fact, he's... Do you know that expression?
No.
Oh, well, I mean, he hasn't got any musical, any sense of music at all. But in actual fact, the older I've got, I realised that he was onto a couple of good things. His idea of heaven back then was, because he's a very sociable man, and his idea of heaven then was sort of Xavier Cugat's Latin Holiday album, you know, on tape at very low volume where they had all his friends round, you know, so they could all talk over it. And I think he thought, for a long time, he thought the best record ever made was the Limbo, but do the Limbo Rock by Chubby Checker. In fact, he couldn't understand why anybody wanted to make any more records after that, that they'd reached a pinnacle.
So what did he think of your songs?
Well, he used to rather endure my records. You know, I'd come home, my mother would get all tearful, you know, and love it, you know. My dad would be shifting uncomfortably in his in his chair, and he'd rather have to endure it. but actually, my last two or three records, he really likes it now, and he gets my act a lot more now.
You had a song, "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding," that was on the soundtrack for The Bodyguard.
Mm.
right?
Yeah.
And I mean that record, mostly Whitney Houston stuff, sold gazillions.
What
of
are you saying? That
and...
you're saying that nobody went out and bought the Bodyguard album for my song? To watch so funny on Peace Love and Mercy? How dare you?
I saw the movie, and I don't remember the song. Where was it used?
Well, I'm not going to tell you if you don't know. Actually, I haven't got a clue. I haven't even seen it.
You haven't seen it?
No.
You're not that curious that you'd go out and even rent it on video?
No, I'm not, actually. I'm not a... Well, I shouldn't say this on the radio. It's a tremendous film, and I'm very, very pleased about everything. Now, I know lots of people who have seen it, and they all tell me that my song isn't in it at all. And even my mother, who has ears like a mum, has sat and watched it, and she said that she couldn't hear it anywhere. But I presume it's on a car radio or something playing in the background.
Right, there's a lot of music like that on jukeboxes. And.
Mm. But I had nothing to do with it at all. You know, I don't feel... It was a fantastic payday for me, you know, and... But I've been writing songs for a long time, and it's a bit like fishing. You know, if you have enough hooks in the water, you know, off the pier, then sooner or later the one fish in the harbour will swim round and bite one of them, you know. So I don't, you know, I just figure I just got lucky. I don't feel any great sense of triumph or anything about it. But it's very handy because it's coincided with... you know, it came along at a time when I got dropped by Warner Brothers. It was my record company beforehand. And so it's enabled me not to miss the record company check, you know, and I can finance my thing properly and do something which is elegant and so that I don't feel I'm wasting my time with.
Well, it's a great song. Can you do a couple of verses for us?
Sure, yeah.
As I walk this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, oh yes, I ask myself, is all hope gone? Is there only pain, hatred, and misery? Oh yeah. And each time I feel like this inside, there's one thing I wanna know. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Ooh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
That's a great song. Elvis Costello recorded that too.
Well, he really brought it to the public's attention. You know, I recorded it with Brinsley Schwartz, that I wrote the song for back in about 73 or 74, and Elvis recorded it and brought it to everyone's attention, really. In fact, a lot of people really think of it as it being Elvis's song.
Well, what was the original tone that you meant that song to have? Irony, serious?
Yeah, it was meant to be a sort of joke, really. I thought it was really pompous, you know, as I walk this wicked world. You know, here I was 22, you know, 22 years old and seen it all. And I thought it was a sort of a joke, you know, except I thought the title was good. I thought that was good. But when Elvis cut it, he really sounded like he meant it and thought it was, you know, he made it sort of anthemic and... if I can use a word, I suppose I can on public radio, can't I? Anthemic. But he really gave it some soul and charged it up.
So did you find yourself singing it differently after hearing him sing it?
Well, I certainly saw it differently. Yeah, I certainly did see it differently, and because it turned people on so much, and you could see how much people really identified with it and liked it, and you can't knock that, you know, when that happens, because there's no rhyme or reason to it why people will grab onto something, and when it happens, it's a wonderful thing.
Nick Lowe is my guest. He has a new CD called The Impossible Bird. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. back with British singer, songwriter, and musician Nick Lowe. What would you say is your approach to writing a song?
I tend to invent a character. And if I invent a character and put the character in a situation, see if I can get the character to write the song. The songs that I write, the person sitting opposite you now, are rather tedious and not very good. I can do it, but if I can invent a character, successfully invent a character to do it for me, whilst I'm sort of agreeing with the character, but if I let the character in my, in the thought process that I have, if I don't get in the way of the characters working out the song, I don't bring my furniture to the house, then sometimes the character can come up with a really something really basic and beautiful, you know, that I would have obscured and not shepherded through clearly.
Maybe you could play a couple of verses from a song from your new album and talk about the kind of character you wrote that for.
Ooh, the character's gone now, so I don't know. See, now everyone pats me on the back, says, Nick, what a great song. And I go, yeah, sure. And I know that I didn't actually have anything to do with it. well, let me see now.
Or maybe the songs are more personal, I don't know.
Well, no, I don't put my diary to music. That's, you know, anyone who's had to sit across a table in a bar, you know, listen to some lovelorn friend bleating on about the breakup of their relationship, you know, and you know how tiresome that can be. I don't see why I should inflict that on my lovely fans. So I make up someone to do it. So I'm trying to explain what it feels like as opposed to tell people what happened to me in my particular circumstance. And that way I can get away with murder. I hope. No. Let me think now. What can I play you then? What about I can do a little bit of 12-step program? You know that song?
Sure.
I'm on a 12-step program to quit your bay. I'm on a 12-step program to quit your baby. I'm tired of whining and pacing the floor. I ain't gonna do it no more on my 12-step program to quit your baby. Step one, I'm gonna tear your picture down. Step two, I'm gonna move the room around. Step three, I'm gonna walk out the door, go looking for number four on my 12-step program to quit you, baby. So on.
That was written for a character?
It was written... A character wrote it, I suppose. I've got myself into a right-on state now, haven't I, with all this nonsense?
Come on, we know you really had a 12-step program to quit somebody.
Yeah.
Confess.
Did it all myself.
Something I like to do during one of our concerts on the show is to ask the performer to sing a song, not one of their own, that we might think of as being totally out of character. So let me ask you if you could think of something to do a song that you really love that we might be surprised to hear that you love.
Wow. Well, I might not know all the words.
That's okay.
I can sort of... I hope I get this right. And I hope this falls into the category that you're...
Many a tear has to fall, but it's all in the game. All in the wonderful game that we know. Love. and your future's looking grim. Do 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 do. Once in a while he won't call, but it's all in the game. Soon he'll be there at your side with a sweet bouquet. Then he'll kiss your lips and caress your waiting fingertips, and your heart and your heart will fly away.
That's great. Nick Lowe recorded in the Fresh Air studio. That last song he did was a number one hit in 1958, recorded by Tommy Edwards. Nick Lowe's new CD, The Impossible Bird, is on Upstart Records. Lowe's on an American tour. He performs in Boston tonight, then continues with stops in many cities, including Philadelphia, New York, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, Cleveland, Chicago, Minneapolis, Dallas, Houston, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, how are you covering the O.J. Simpson trial?
Well, we'll have a report from Rene Montaigne on opening statements in the murder trial of O.J. Simpson. Today, the prosecution began by giving what it sees as the motive of the killing and describing the relationship of O.J. Simpson and his former wife. Said he was always out to control her, obsessed with him. We'll hear about that and what the defense said. Also on today's program, looking ahead to this evening's State of the Union address by President Clinton. We'll get a sense of what he is likely to propose. And we'll also hear from a number of Americans around the country what they think the State of the Union is, at least what they think it is at the workplace.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Dagoberto Gilb is the author of two books of fiction. He worked in construction before he became a full-time writer. Being a writer is an occupation that he still finds takes some getting used to.
For many years, I lived and wrote in a solitude that wasn't just the usual, necessary quiet of every writer, the desk, the chair, the sealed-off room. I earned money in an inarticulate world that stretched out electrical cords in the morning, humped construction material, ripped and banged and drilled, then in late afternoon wrapped those cords up again, collected tools, drank beer and talked, never about books. Outside the room I closed myself in to write was the city of El Paso. 300 miles from everything, it is far away from much of what you take for granted, like bookstores. Which probably explains a lot of why my recent book tour seemed like an adventure to a new continent and a different time. Suddenly I was being accosted by these inhabitants, readers, who I always wanted to exist, but conceived of more as fictional characters, not human beings. Sometimes these real people would approach me and ask questions. One was, "How did you become a writer?" They didn't mean it like that might sound, as in rhetorically, with a sarcastic overemphasis on you. I promise, they were curious in a complimentary way. And I couldn't easily explain the phenomena either. I told them that I suspected a disease. Now that I'm back in my El Paso solitude, I want to offer evidence of my insight. You might remember last month's news about President Clinton's Miami summit with the leaders of the 32 nations of North and South America. What you don't know about was a pre-summit gathering, a weekend a month earlier, in Washington, D.C. and Annapolis, Maryland, of artists, journalists, and scholars from the two continents. Among the 30 or so invited were Maria Elena Cruz Varela, the Cuban poet who spent 2 years in Castro's prison, Sergio Ramirez, current leader of the Sandinistas in the Nicaraguan National Assembly, and Father Gustavo Gutierrez, the Peruvian priest who started what we know of as the Liberation Theology Movement. Also included was Richard Rodriguez, the essayist, Seymour Lipset, the sociologist, Elena Castelo, the novelist, Stanley Crouch, the jazz critic, and me. Our first evening, we were all invited to Alan Tipper Gore's vice presidential residence, the Admiralty House. It was pomp and circumstance of categorical distance from my El Paso life, and as is my manner, my disease, I could not focus in on the appropriate specifics, like conversation. As others are getting to know one another, combining bites of hors d'oeuvres off silver platters and banter with ambassadors, I'm staring at the furniture, picture frames, or the casings around the doors and windows, the base and crown moldings. Mr. Gore directs us to a circle of chairs before we enter the dining room, and though I'm sure he's discussing this new moment in the Americas, the new opportunities that a group such as ours coming together symbolizes, I'm not hearing a word. Instead, I'm watching how he articulates, his mannerisms as they contrast against a window that, from my angle, is behind him. I'm looking at the shoes he's wearing, a black cowboy boot, and a Velcro cast that looks more like a hiking shoe, and I'm looking at how these others are listening to him. And I've also noticed that the circles have divided into semis that are not north and south. On one side, bland bureaucratic suits, dark blue and gray. On the other, artistic colors and patterns, yellow and red and orange and elegant black. At dinner time, when we're asked to interpret this event, while others seem to have outlines with like Roman numerals, all I can say is that I feel like I'm at a wedding. You see what I mean about my ailment. Another question that came up in the tour was, do you think all of this attention, the new world you're being introduced to, will affect your work? I always said no, I have too much material. But privately, the answer was just as much yes. Since I bought this house my writer room is in over a year ago, an old front door had been hanging there, ugly and getting even uglier, without even a threshold, waiting for me to replace it. So I drove my pickup to the builder's store. I haggled a $350 door down to $80, got out my level and square and tape and skill saw, pencil and chisel, the drill and the hole saws. I stained and varnished it. Not to sound too immodest, but I'm pleased to say the answer really is no, it has not affected my work.
Doug Oberto Gilb is the author of The Magic of Blood and The Last Known Residence of Miki Acuna. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.